This is Confessions of a Book Collector. I'm your host, David Headley, and I will be exploring all aspects of publishing and book collecting, interviewing best-selling and upcoming authors, and sharing insights on books both old and new. Welcome back to Confessions of Book Collector. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Anita Frank. Anita Frank is an author that I represent, and I proudly do so because I think that Anita is probably one of the most gifted, talented, clever writers writing. And I remember reading her first book, The Lost Ones. I was in New York, and it was sent to me on email, and I couldn't put it down. And by the end of that, I emailed Anita and went, oh no, I need to represent you. And I got, oh, well, there's lots of interest in me, so shall we meet? Hello, Anita.
Hello. Is it like that?
Yeah.
Blimey, that's quite an intro.
I think you'd been offered representation.
I had been offered representation by someone else, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I won, so to speak. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
I know that you listen to all of them.
I'm a big fan.
Every episode that goes out, you always comment on, and you're so kind. So it seems to me that you needed to be the first author for our third series.
Oh, how exciting. Thank you.
And it will come out at the same time as your new book, The Brilliant, The Good Liars. Do you want to tell people about The Good Liars? I think it's your best book yet. But
it's very different to the other two, isn't it?
The Good Liars is a murder mystery set in 1920. And the First World War casts a very long shadow over the events of the book. It starts off really in 1914, where a young boy has disappeared and he vanishes without a trace and is never found again. And the main action of the book starts in 1920, when a letter leads the police to reopen the investigation into his disappearance. And that brings them into the realm of the Stillwell family, who own Darkacre Hall, because the letter has implied that the boy was on the property when he disappeared. Now, the Stillwell family have been very affected by the First World War. The eldest son, who was due to inherit, was killed early on. And his two brothers have come back very damaged in their own way. Morris has been deeply affected by shell shock, and is no longer the man he once was, much to the annoyance of his rather socially ambitious wife, Ida. And his brother, Leonard, has unfortunately come back severely disabled and is trying to come to terms and struggling to do so with the body that he's come back with, which is very different to the body that he went out with, and has therefore altered his life prospects hugely. And added into the mix is their long-standing family friend, Victor, who is like a permanent house guest and seems rather reluctant to leave. The reason being, we find out as the book progresses. So this is a very disturbed family. They've got a lot of secrets and a lot of troubles, and they all rise to the surface as a spotlight is thrown on events of that summer just before the war broke out.
It is incredible. The First World War does, as you say, cast a shadow over it and the damage that the war has done to people, but also how people have reacted, certainly the mistress of the house, how she was perceived and how she is perceived now, having done what she has done. The great thing about it's called The Good Liars because everyone is hiding something. Everyone.
That's right.
But you don't know actually what's important and what's not. But all of it adds up to a brilliant golden age mystery.
Yes, because in addition, there's the sergeant who comes to investigate the boy's disappearance as well, who again is another invalid of the First World War. There's loads going on, and there's loads of mystery, and there's a bit of spookiness as well, because obviously we have got that dead brother, and is he still lurking or is he not still lurking? So there's lots going on, and hopefully it will be a bit of a mystery that will keep people guessing until the last page.
I have to say, when I read it for the first time, and you'd sent it to me, I thought, we're going back to to the lost ones, having you'd written a brilliant book called The Return, which is a masterpiece. And I thought, oh, this is where we're going for the, she's going back to, and then I realised that actually you were going to be more clever than that.
Yeah, I mean, it started off life as a sequel to The Lost Ones,
right?
The Good Liars.
And then for various reasons, I didn't go ahead and write the sequel, but I just loved the characters and I loved the central story idea. So I did turn it into a standalone. So this book was started a long time ago and it just got put aside and then I picked it up again. It must have been just after I'd finished The Return, I picked it up again and started reworking it because it was one of those I just couldn't get out of my head. I was supposed to be writing something else. And as I was writing the book I had sold to my editor that I was going to be writing, I just had these characters whispering in my ear that their story was far more interesting than the one that I was working on. So I thought, I'll just finish it and get it out of the way.
So war features in all three books so far. Is there a reason for that? Do you want to explore what happens to people because of a war?
Yeah, and this very much goes back to actually my reading history. Perhaps a bit bizarrely, when I was 12, I got very into the Vietnam War and I started reading mostly memoirs. But between the ages of 12 and 18, probably 70% of my reading material was either memoirs of soldiers who'd fought in the Vietnam War, or it was histories of the war, or it was fiction set in the war. And I think that opened me up to that experience. And it was fascinating. You know, you take ordinary people who have no ambitions to be in the army or to be soldiers or anything like that, and you put them in this incredible and often intolerable situation where they are fighting, which is something that can be completely alien to their nature, to their ambitions and will, but they're forced to do it. It becomes a battle of survival. And I found that a really interesting situation for Joe Bloggs Off the Street to be put in. And of course, then there are the after effects of those experiences as well. So I do find that very, very interesting. And I think that's probably why it becomes a backdrop in all of my books. And in a way, the book I'm working on now, it's the same thing. So it's definitely an area that I find really interesting. And it's human nature and the impact, as I say, of those incredible pressures on a normal person and how that impacts them and alters their life course. I think
yeah.
That's very interesting.
We've had conversations about this before, the way that you are so attuned to humanity. And some of the sentences I've said to you before, when I'm reading your book, they stop me dead because it's your perception is incredible. And the way that you explain something, and it really does make me think, God, what a talented and clever writer.
Very kind. I do think putting yourself into things like memoirs, it just, for me, it triggered a sense of empathy that I probably hadn't had there beforehand. And that's something that I do whenever I'm writing. I try and really put myself in somebody else's shoes. And of course, everybody reacts differently to different situations. But I think those books and having that experience of that reading, which then led me on to obviously other topics that were related and reading histories and memoirs of other people, I think it does make you start understanding what makes people tick and appreciating, even if you don't necessarily agree with their actions, you can appreciate where those actions come from.
So obviously this podcast is going out to celebrate the launch of The Good Liars, which is out on the 17th of August. Are you looking forward to it? I think your publishers have produced the most beautiful book.
The cover is fabulous. And I will plug as well that there is a Goldsborough special edition, which is even more fabulous, which has got just gorgeous gilt and spreadges as well. So the special edition really is very, very special.
Yeah, those digital edges are amazing.
Yeah, it's
very beautiful. Gorgeous.
And I wasn't expecting that. It's got gilt and also turquoise foil, and I wasn't expecting that.
We like to treat our Goldsborough customers.
Well, I think they are in for a visual treat, even if they don't like the contents.
No, they will. The contents are amazing. Their content is amazing. And As I said, when you sent it to me, I was overjoyed because it was a Golden Age mystery, and I always thought that you could do that. But I wasn't expecting it to be so clever. Just because the way that we had spoken, you said, I can't do plot.
Oh, no, I can do plot. I think I can do plot. I can't do prose.
I really...
What? Oh, what?
I
no,
can do you... plot. I
would say plot and dialogue. I can do. I just can't write prose. I really, that to me is hard work. I'm a script writer. I am very, when I am writing, it is a film playing in my head. And all I'm trying to do is put what I see in my head on the page.
And you do that beautifully. You can write the most beautiful prose. There are sentences, as I've said to you, that will stop me dead, literally stop reading, because I think, what an extraordinarily clever visual way of saying something. So in the Good Liars, there is a scene where they're all sitting in the living room, and I think we've discussed this before, where the man just turns in the corner of the sofa like a jar lid tightening. I haven't done you justice. Your prose is way better than me explaining it. You are a very clever, brilliant, clever writer. How long does it take you to write a book like that?
When I get going, I write badly, very, very quickly. So I do a lot of editing afterwards to try and make it a lot better. But the actual story, the plot, the dialogue tends to all come out in the first draft. And with The Good Liars, I had written, as I say, when I was writing what I thought was going to be the sequel to The Lost Ones, I'd got down about 40,000, and that probably took me a couple of months. And then I put it aside, and as I say, I was working on something else and I just needed to get it out of my head. So I actually, for the first time ever, did NaNoWriMo. And I just thought I didn't want to spend loads of time on it because I thought it was just an aside. I didn't think it would be a book. So I thought if I can just write 40,000 words in the month of November, then I can have a finished book and put it aside. I've done the story and I can move on. That's what I did. So it probably took me, therefore, 3 months to get the first draft. And then I think I sent it to you in the end of February. I didn't work on it on December, but I basically polished it up and edited it, which is polishing. It doesn't tend to be changing the story or the events. It doesn't change the order of events or the dialogue. Mainly my editing, it tends to be polishing that wretched prose.
Yeah, and actually I didn't do any editing on this book. I didn't have very much feedback apart from praise, and then when we sent it to your editor said there's very little to do. Mm. And you were really shocked about that.
Yeah, well, I had never thought that it was going to be a book. I just thought this was just, you know, as I say, it was just for me, it was getting those characters out of my head so I could actually move on and work on the book that I was supposed to be writing.
I think it's really remarkable how hard authors treat themselves and how much punishment they give themselves. And then they think everything they write is rubbish. And then when you read it, you're like, oh my God, this is so amazing. Because authors tell me all the time, like, I'm writing a book, David, you're going to hate it. It's really rubbish. And I read it and think, God, this is really brilliant. What on earth are you talking about? But I like the fact that you're pushing yourself and you're putting all of your energy and effort into it, because it will make the book better.
Yeah, I think I am a bit...
super critical.
No, I was going to say.
Yeah, it's a clean book. super critical.
My life's so.
I try. I, as I say, I do polish and I do read every version of the copy edits and the proof edits, and even when you get the printed proof, I'm going through that with a fine tooth comb, trying to make sure that it is as tight as I can get it. So I do try to be as professional as I can in producing a good book. And I am critical. I am very critical. And that
of yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, especially when I'm going into that first draft. It takes me a long time to realise I might actually have something that's okay. Even when I sent it to you, I thought, I'm sending it to you because I've spent the time on it, so I might as well. But even then, I was expecting you to come back and say, yeah, just carry on working on the one you're supposed to be doing.
No, well, anyway, I've already said I think it's your best book. And I don't mean that in the sense that it's better than the other two, because the other two are really amazing. I mean, it's better in the sense that I think it's more commercial, and I think that you've captured the right time to bring this book out because of the Golden Age mystery and because it seems to be the
it's very hot at the moment, isn't it?
And tell me about your reading habits, and have you always been a reader?
God, yes. Always. We were always encouraged to read. My mum and dad are not readers at all, so we never had books in the house. And they had both been made to leave school at 15 for various reasons. My dad had to go and work on the farm and my mum had to get a job. And I think they both really resented that because they both would have liked to have stayed on in school. So education was a huge focus in our household, and they made massive sacrifices to give us the best education that they could. And my mum understood that reading was the route into education. So we were always encouraged to read. If ever we were out and we wanted a book, there was no question we would have that book. So other things would get denied. If you wanted sweets or toys or anything like that, it was like, no. But if we turned up with a book and said, can I have this? It was always, yep, put it in. We'll get that. But as a result, because they weren't readers, my reading history was a bit chaotic and probably very eclectic. And I was certainly reading things that at an inappropriate age shouldn't have been reading, because there was no guidance, and because it was something that neither of my parents were interested in, nobody checked what I was reading.
So what were we talking about?
I remember, oh my God, I got my sexual education from Shirley Conran's Lace when I was about 12. I thought it was great. I read it like four times. I thought it was really good. But even when I was like 10, I remember, because I would just go into a bookshop and look at what was on the table or what was on the display, and I would just read the back. And if the back sounded interesting, I would think, oh, I'll read that. And at the age of 10, you know, if I was picking up a crime novel about, you know, two little girls who had been kidnapped and were being held, and it didn't cross my mind that that might be an adult book that I probably shouldn't be reading. So I'd trot up to the counter with mum going, oh, can I have this? And she would just say, oh, it's a book. Yes, of course. So there was no sort of restrictions on what we read. And we did end up reading, or I did end up reading, some inappropriate things, things I wouldn't be letting my children read at that age.
Yeah, and I would say too, when I was growing up, my mum and dad used to dump me at my granny's over the summer, just probably to get rid of me, to get them out of their hair for a couple of weeks. And that's when I started to read quite adult books, because that's all that was in my nana's house. And I think my mum and dad would have been shocked if they'd have known what I was reading, questioning why my granny reads that kind of perversion is a different matter. but they were books of their time. But yeah, that's how I was a voracious reader too. And I read a lot of adult books.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, it never crossed my mind when I was doing it, but there was like this massive, and as I say, because there weren't books in our house, listening to a lot of these podcasts, people have moved from Enid Blyton to Agatha Christie or whatever, because that's what their parents have got on the bookshelves. And that there just wasn't that in our house. We didn't have any books. And my brother is 4 years older than me, but was very precious about his books. And obviously I was a girl. So he didn't really like me touching his books. So he read all of the Narnia and the Lord of the Rings and all that. But they were his like favourite books. So I haven't read any of them. I've loved the Lord of the Rings films, and I love the Narnia films, but that's how I've discovered those stories. I've never read them. So I jumped from, you know, Enid Blyton, who I absolutely adored and totally instilled that desire to be a writer, came from reading Enid Blyton and that sense of adventure, to reading adult books that I went in and picked up not really realising that they were adult books.
Did you read Agatha Christie?
No, I read my first Agatha Christie 2 years ago.
Really? Which one?
A Blue Train.
Oh, yeah. Very early one.
Yeah.
So I just, because I, as I say, I've got these, as a result, I've got these huge gaps in what I ought to have read, should have read. And I did English at school, and I'd always wanted to be a writer, even from the age of six. So I always expected to do English at university. I then thought I'd probably do journalism because that seemed to be the obvious way into writing, and then I would start writing books.
So from a very early age at six, you wanted to be a writer. Did you know what a writer was then? You knew what a novelist was?
Absolutely, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And why?
Because I was not a very successful child or person. And it quickly became apparent that in my imagination I could be far more successful than I was in real life. And I had this really, my mum was very strict. I had a very restrictive childhood. And I remember reading at a very young age, Enid Blyton, as they all pack up their greaseproof paper wrap sandwiches and a couple of bottles of ginger beer and disappear for the day with their parents not knowing where they were. I couldn't go into the garden for half an hour without having a audible check of, are you still in the garden? Because obviously I might have been abducted by aliens or whatever. I don't know what she was thinking. But so for me, that was mind blowing that you could actually have these children going out and having this adventure. And that made my imagination far more exciting than anything that was happening in my real life.
I didn't know what I wanted to be. I mean, at nine, I wanted to be a priest, and so I then trained to be a priest. But at nine, I did know that I probably wanted to be a priest, but I didn't want to do anything else. But you wanted to be...
I started my first book at six. I have absolute strong memory. It didn't get very far. It had a killer opening line, which I can't remember, but I remember being so proud.
Please find it.
I remember it was about penguins, and it was during the Christmas holidays. It had a very large picture of a snowman on, but the opening line was brilliant. And I remember as I wrote that opening line thinking, that's like a proper opening line from a book.
You say killer line, it's penguins, not killer penguins.
No, it wasn't killer penguins. It only got dark later.
No, so I just, yeah, so I always knew. And my favourite lesson at school, even from junior school into senior school, was story writing. So when you're allowed to use your imagination and just write a story, there were no restrictions. There weren't, you have to have these words in it or you have to do this. I just loved that. I got into trouble in senior school with my English teacher because I would take it to the nth degree. So rather than writing the stipulated three sides in your exercise book, I finished my exercise book and on one occasion wrote 10 extra double-sided pages of A4, at which point she did take me aside and said, I've just spent 2 hours marking your homework. And I had actually allotted 2 hours to mark the entire class.
She's lovely, Mrs. Jim. She said, if you ever want to write anything, and I will read it for pleasure and let you know what I think.
She said, but you can't do this for homework anymore. So I got into trouble.
Isn't it funny? I was talking to Jack Jordan about this school education and how it can be disruptive, but not in a good way.
Well, yeah, and I have to say, I had always expected to do, as I say, English at university. That was totally all I'd ever thought of doing. And I got to do English A-level and absolutely hated it.
Really?
Oh, my God, I hated it.
I hated it. I didn't like being told what to read. Although, in all honesty, if I hadn't had formal education, I would never have dipped my toe in the classics or Shakespeare or anything like that. And I hated the analysis and I hated breaking things down. I just wanted to read for pleasure. So actually, I would sit and loathe my English lessons at A-level, but I would go into history and I would sit there hearing bits of information and then start spinning them into a story. So that's when I thought, okay, I'm going to go to university and do history because I'm going to write historical fiction. And that's why I did history at university.
And you're very good at it.
Maybe. Don't check my historical facts.
I think we have to, but it's generally brilliant. And so when you're doing your course, when you're doing English Lit and you're doing your degree, did it make you love books more or did you dislike books? Because I know that when we talk about books, you do pick up on things. I'm critical because I'm an agent, but how do you enjoy reading still?
Oh, God, yeah, I love reading.
But are you more critical or not? I've never asked this before an author. Sorry to put you on the spot.
That's all right.
But when you're reading your peers' books, would you say, oh, she's this really great book, but I wish, would you have done this?
Sometimes I can be very critical. I think anybody who's had me beta read for them would say I'm really critical. And sometimes I can. I used to finish every book I started. And however hard and intolerable that was, I would bitterly get through to the end of a book. And then my husband said to me, I think he had a teacher at school who had said, life is too short to read bad books.
Yeah.
And he's the other way. He's, if you haven't got him by the end of the first chapter, he'll put a book down and he will not open it again. So I started not finishing books I wasn't enjoying after a few years of being married to him. And that was quite liberating.
I wouldn't say that there are bad books. I think sometimes there are books that they're just not for us.
They're not for us.
And I remember a teacher at my university saying, and we're talking about some of those books that are what we call classics, and I said, this is so boring. And he says, because you're not ready for it. And I like to think that that's a way of looking at some of the books.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is funny, at school you are supposed to read these, I don't know, literature. And I remember we had a rubbish fiction library at school. It really wasn't very good. And I remember we had an enforced English lesson in the fiction library, and we all had to choose a book from the fiction library. And I was going around these shelves thinking, there is just nothing that is shouting out to me here. And I'm, you know, I was like, at that stage of my life, I was probably a 4 books a week girl. You know, I loved reading. And I remember my English teacher coming up to me and saying, well, what have you been reading at home? And I had just that week, I think, finished a Danielle Steele, and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. And I said, oh, I've just finished this Danielle Steele. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And I was probably, you know, I was like 13, 14. I was like, oh, it's brilliant. And she just looked at me and went, I think you should be reading something of better quality than that. And I just thought, well, actually, do you know what? I really enjoyed that book. That took me out of myself. It fired my imagination. I think I laughed in places. It made me feel something. And I hate, therefore, the snobbery around books that you should be reading of a certain caliber. I just think read for pleasure.
Absolutely. What's well, you know my thoughts on that.
Absolutely.
I've been very vocal about that. And I still think there's quite a lot of snobbery. As I say in Goldsborough, we don't have a literature section.
No.
I think it's profoundly wrong to say something is better than something else. Great writing is great writing, but lots of people write great writing in all sorts of genres and all sorts of ways.
And as readers, we come to every book from a completely different place, from a different background. We've all read different books to get us to that book that we pick up off the shelf. So we're going to have a different reaction to it depending on what's gone before and how we've felt about what's gone before that we've read. So it's very subjective, and I think it is all down to the individual. And just because I hate a book doesn't mean somebody else is not going to love it. I think that's a completely natural, healthy situation.
Absolutely. And so thinking back to when you grew up and there was no books in your home, I'm assuming your house is now full of books.
I got banned.
What?
I got banned.
So my ambition from a very wee age, and this is when obviously I was living in my imagination and thought I was going to move into some stately mansion at some point in my life, which sadly has not happened. I kept every single book that I'd ever bought, read, everything was kept. And after a few years of marriage, my husband said, we literally can't do this anymore because there's no room. And I did have to start giving books away and getting rid of books. And that has been a trend that's continued. So I do have quite a few books. At the moment, sadly, most of my books are in
boxes up the loft.
Because you're moving?
No, because there was no space.
There's no space. Okay.
But when we move, I am... Sorry, just to let everybody know, we are moving in the next few weeks, hopefully, God willing. And I'm going to get a room of my own, which is quite frankly the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me. So I am hoping that at that point, I will be able to get all my books out on display.
Are you a book collector?
No.
No, it doesn't.
So the format doesn't mean anything to you?
No, I have to have a book. I can't do e-books. To me, that's not a proper book. So right. I have to have a book. But I'm not precious.
So you don't have any books in your collection or in your, but you would not want to give away or you couldn't give away?
There are books that I have really enjoyed. So what I do now is keep the books I really enjoy. But that's because of how that book's made me feel at that moment that I read it, not because it's got a gorgeous cover necessarily, or because I wouldn't know about first editions and things like that. I'm a bog standard reader.
I, look, you're a reader, and that's all I... Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is Confessions of a Book Collector, but that's more confession. About my... Well, we'll go into the confessional soon, because I want to talk to you about a book, but we'll come to that. But let's look at your children. Are they big readers?
No.
They're not big readers either?
No.
You haven't instilled in them reading?
Went horribly wrong. No. I mean, I always read to them, and I always encouraged them to read. But none of them are readers.
Is that just because of their age, do you think? Because they're young, aren't they?
Early 20s. And I think both of them are more inclined to read nonfiction. If they're going to read anything, it would be a nonfiction book, which I find really sad. Not that nonfiction's not great, but I just think fiction is such a wonderful thing. It's so wonderful to lose yourself in the pages of a book, and it's such a relaxing thing to do, and it can bring you all the emotions. It can bring you happiness and tears and excitement and thrill and devastation. I just think it's a wonderful thing to be able to read a book.
Yeah.
So I find it really sad that they don't.
Tell me about some of the books you've read recently that you've really loved.
I have really loved In Memoriam,
oh, yes.
Which I just thought was wonderful and heartbreaking. And obviously that's...
A book set in the Second World War?
First World War. First World War.
Still.
A book set... Gosh. How against type, Anita, that you like that one.
No, I just thought that and the whole schoolboy element, which... it's just heartbreaking, isn't it? It's absolutely heartbreaking.
There's a book of the month at Goldsborough. I loved it.
Yeah, really good book.
I really enjoyed one of the books I've read. I probably read it last year, Raft of Stars by Andrew J. Graff, which is one of those books. I was sent a proof, and I think I started it really late Saturday night before I went to bed. And then on the Sunday, I thought, I'll just read a chapter. And it was one of those books I didn't move off the sofa. And I resented people making me do things that made me move off the sofa. And it was a gem of a book, because for me, I laughed, I cried, I gasped aloud at one moment and went, no way! And it was just, it ticked all the boxes for me. So I really enjoyed that.
I didn't know that book.
I came about it last year. It was a debut with my publisher, HQ Stories, actually. I think it was last year. Time flies.
And what's it about?
It's set in America, in, you know, I don't know what county, what state it's set in, I can't remember. But these two little boys, they're about 12, something happens. They think they've done something really bad. And so they write an apology note and disappear into the wilderness, taking, you know, meagre provisions with them. And then you've got the family, the boys' mothers, you've got the grandfather, you've got the town sheriff, all walking into this apparent crime scene and thinking, where are the boys? We've got to find the boys, because they've gone off on this journey trying to find one of their fathers. And they've not got the skills to survive in that wilderness. So these various groups all start off going in. You've got the sheriff, who's fairly new in town and is just a duck out of water. You've got this wizened, hardened grandfather who's, you know, king of the outback. He knows how to survive in this environment, and the sheriff, who hasn't got a clue how to survive in this environment. So there's loads of humour, but then there's an awful lot of poignant moments as well, and some very, very moving moments. And then you've got the mother turning up going, I don't care if they told me to stay out, that's my child in there, I'm going out. And it's very funny, and there's loads of relationship dynamics and things like that.
Sounds wonderful. Yeah. When's it set?
I think it was like the 1980s, I want to say, right, that it was set. Apologies if that's wrong. But it was, as I say, for me, it ticked all of the emotion boxes when reading a book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, there's a recommendation for you, which I know I'm going to seek it out, because I didn't know about the book, or at least it's passed me by for some reason. But let's go to the confessional. Mm. I always do this, as you well know, because you listen to every episode. Tell me about a book in your collection that if you're moving. So if your husband said, right, you can bring one book with you, what book would that be?
I have thought about this question, because obviously I knew it was coming. And it's really hard, because I don't think there is one fiction book that I've read that's had a massive impact on me that I've thought, I couldn't live without that book. Or I love that story. And I'm not a great rereader of books. I will sometimes go back and reread a book, but I'm not a great rereader. There's, I suppose, a sentimental attachment. I'm talking around the point to try and name other books, if you notice I'm doing that quite cunningly. There's like a sentimental attachment. The Children of Cherry Tree Farm was an Enid Blyton one, and that probably, I read that when I was six, and that probably set me on the path of knowing I wanted to be a writer. That's when reading really fired me up. But if the house was burning, would I burn my hand off trying to get it? I don't know. But I think if there is a book that's had a massive impact on me as a person and probably as the writer I have become, it's a non-fiction book. Is that allowed?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a non-fiction book, and it's called Once a Warrior King by David Donovan, who was a lieutenant in the Vietnam War. So it's a memoir. And it launched my interest in the Vietnam War, really. I think I'm we're the same age, aren't we? And in those sort of early 1980s, everything was connected with Vietnam, all the TV programs, the characters of Vietnam vets and all the rest of it. And as like a 8-10 year old, I didn't know what Vietnam was. And I remember asking my dad for, you know, what is Vietnam? And he gave me a potted history. And about the same time or shortly after, Platoon was coming out.
Yeah,
you know,
movie.
You always used the trailers on TV, and I was desperate to go and watch it, but I was far too young, so there was no way I was going to go and watch it. And then my brother came back from his school one day with Oliver Stone's, who obviously is a veteran himself, Oliver Stone's book of the film. And he said, oh, I know you can't go and see it, so here's the book. And I think I read that in a day, and I really liked it. And I said to him, are there any more books like that? And he said, oh yeah, there's a whole shelf on Vietnam. And I said, well, could you get me another one? And he came home with Once a Warrior King by David Donovan. And I just devoured it. I absolutely devoured it. And it was like, I want another one like that. I want another one like that. And it goes through his experiences as a very naive young man joining the army, then going and doing his tour in Vietnam, but then also the impact of that war when he comes back and he's teaching in an English class and just not adapting, not readjusting to civilian life. And it just had a profound effect on me, I think. And as I say, it really opened up my sense of empathy, or introduced me to a sense of empathy.
Well, you do that with your characters, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think, and that was the interesting thing, knowing that I was coming on the podcast and thinking about what books had impacted me.
But you wouldn't write a book around Vietnam?
I wouldn't feel I had the right to. My one condition when I got married, before we started a family, my one condition was we had to go to Vietnam, because that had been my ambition since I was 12. I'd read all of these books. And obviously, I'd watched every single documentary going on TV. I'd watched all the films by that stage, so I could visualise it. But I just wanted to be there to fully understand everything. And we did. We went to Vietnam for 3 weeks with a 3-day tour of Laos as well, which was just amazing. And that was an incredible experience.
But you couldn't find a way of telling a story that we'd feel comfortable.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because obviously I'm not sure I would. Right. I don't know. I'm not sure I would. I feel too much about it all to tell that story.
Have you seen Miss Saigon?
Yes. Yeah. I've seen that a couple of times. Took my girls to see it as well.
So. I the first time I saw it, I uncontrollably sobbed at the end.
It's great. It is great, isn't it?
I think it should come back.
I think it will, because we saw it originally when it was in the West End, Rod and I did. And then when it came back, I said to my girls, you've got to come and see this. And a friend of mine had got the tape of it, so I knew all the songs and I was singing the songs when I was a child. So I just loved it.
I saw the Palace Theatre when it first came here. I think it was in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I saw that helicopter come down on the stage and it blew me away.
I have to say, that is one of the... As you know, I love theatre. So that is one of the scenes that has stayed with me of all the theatre productions I've seen.
Incredible.
It is extraordinary. And then when they brought it back, they didn't. They did the sound and then they had like a silhouette of a helicopter, but it wasn't. It really disappointed me.
Yes.
Well, anyway, sorry we digress, but I am fascinated by this. I'm fascinated by this because I mean, you said we're the same age. I was obsessed with war, but only because of the Cold War, because we all expected a nuclear war as we were growing up.
And that was really scary, wasn't it?
Was.
All those, what to do, how to make your nuclear shelter out of a door propped against the bottom of your stairs, which kind of isn't going to do anything if there's a nuclear bomb. But no, for me, it was Vietnam, but that was because I was so, like I say, I was a massive A-Team fan, very sad. I was a massive A-Team fan. To the extent you want another confession.
Yeah, no, we're in the confessional. Carry on.
I'm only going to say this because Brian McGilloway said something similar and I thought, oh, maybe I'm not the odd person in the room then. He said in his podcast, I hope I'm not misquoting him, that he used to make up characters to go with TV series. And I so did that. And I not only made up characters, I had complete story arcs. I would actually physically sit down and rewrite episodes, including a script for those characters. I did that all the time.
Unfortunately, we can't do anything of that because of licensing and copyright. Who knew? Indeed.
So I was a huge A-Team fan and did create a whole new character. Women were really badly represented in the 80s. I always hated the way women were portrayed. They were never quite tough enough. They were never quite self-sufficient enough. They were all a bit weak. So I used to create my own.
Like Private Benjamin.
Rock hard female. No, she was pathetic.
Maybe she wasn't, though, was she? She was, well, she wasn't originally. But
in the end, she pulled it together, didn't she? But that was more through chaos and
I love that.
Chance.
I love that.
It was the cleaning the toilet floor.
So I liked my kick butt women. So I used to write a lot of kick butt women to TV programmes. But everything was Vietnam. You've got Equalizer, Magnum, A-Team. There was another one I'm trying to think of. Greatest Thing, right? It's Hunter and McCall. Do you remember that one? Yeah. Sorry, I did a little. You see how sad I am? It was the greatest thing since rock and roll. It's Sergeants Rick Hunter and Dee Dee McCall.
I don't know that. I don't know. I must have been so much of a bookworm that I just literally watch anything.
See, I loved telly.
We never went to the cinema, but we did have TV. And I was a big TV fan. I watched an awful lot of TV because we didn't do anything else. We didn't. So it was books and TV. That was the only.
Yeah, I'm still the same. I can take TV or leave it. I mean, there are some. I'm obsessed with some of the like Succession and lots of great shows. Silo, which is the TV series on Disney Plus it's based on Wool by Hugh Howey, which I'm obsessed with, and Foundation. I like a lot of genre fantasy science fiction in TV, but I'm not a massive. I don't read it as much as I.
That.
Yeah, I love watching it.
Yeah, interestingly, I think science fiction is the one thing that I've never read. It's probably the only genre I've not read a lot of. I really got into fantasy when I was younger and read a lot of fantasy, and I loved all of that.
But I did read Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe and loved it, and I read Lord of the Rings and loved it.
I read the Dragonlance series and loved that. So
right.
And David Eddings.
And did you ever read those books where you'd get to page 13 and say, where do you want to go? Do you want to go to page 27?
Yes.
Or do you want to go? And I loved those as well.
Yes, those are very exciting because you could read those several times and you could dip in and you know, they only took like an
hour. I didn't like the way it went. I'd go back and reread and I'd go the other way.
I don't want to do that way. I want my ending to be different.
I think they should bring those back. I think somebody tried recently. Anyway, as we come to a close, tell us, if you wish, about the book that you're working on.
Well, of course, there is a book I'm working on. That doesn't actually mean that book will ever see the light of day.
I might know a little bit about this. You hate me because I didn't love the last one.
Yeah, but I think that's honest, isn't it? I'm very honest about the whole writing process. And I am not going to sit here and say I'm the world's best writer and I know what I'm doing because I haven't got a clue. I literally sit down without a clue every time. And I haven't done any courses and I didn't do a writing degree and I haven't done a how-to and I don't understand what beats are. I just don't understand any of it. So
I think I
would. You're just a gifted writer.
Then. Well, I don't know. I just go in with my film rolling in my head. The one I am currently playing with, not necessarily ever going to produce, but I'm currently playing with, I'm going back further, which is a bit scary for me because I'm going back to Victorian times. And whilst I have always absorbed a lot of literature and films set in that period, I've not studied it really. Did a women's history course, which was very good at uni. So that's slightly daunting. But it is...
Late or early?
Late. It's going to be about 18. I need an event to have happened, and there's an event that happens in 1875. So it's going to be after 1875. But basically, a little baby disappears from their cot in their fairly well-to-do home as everybody else is sleeping in the house. And the family call in a detective from Scotland Yard to help the local plod, because they don't trust the local plod to do a good job, and find the child. And nobody heard a thing. This child has just literally vanished in the night from an apparently locked house with everybody sleeping on the floor below or in the rooms alongside. And the London detective has to try and find out what's happened. And he's got a bit of a past of his own that he's trying to keep under control and under wraps as it's all going on.
I can't wait to read it. How much have you played with it, as you say?
I've got the full plot, so I know exactly what's going to happen. In my head, it's great.
Is it based on a true story?
There are two true stories that I am drawing on. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts in the preparation for putting my house on the market as I'm painting walls. And it's drawing on two events that happened. So there's the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which happened in the 1930s in America. And then there was the first kidnapping for ransom in America, which happened in 1875. I hope I've got the date right there. That's off the top of my head. Of a little boy called Charlie Ross. And they proved to be the inspiration. I've taken it in a bit of a different direction, but those, I just think that's really interesting. Like the Lindbergh baby was taken while his parents were asleep on the floor below and the house was occupied, which is just quite an interesting setup, isn't it? Interesting premise. And little Charlie Ross, as I say, it was the first kidnapping for ransom and it went around the world. It was widely reported in this country as well. And he was never seen again, very sadly. He was kidnapped in front of his house with his little brother, and his little brother was returned, and Charlie was never seen again.
And your book is going to go in a different direction.
Yeah. Can't say too much.
And did you research that, or did you come across it?
Literally, as I say, I've done a lot of decorating in the last few months.
Oh, yeah, you listen to podcasts.
It was just listening to. I do like, and if anybody after listening to this podcast wants to give me recommendations for historical crime podcasts, please do. So I've been listening to a lot of podcasts, and some sort of strike a note with you and others don't, but I love history. I find anything to do with history and social history and all that fascinating. So I always like listening to historical podcasts and picking up little bits, and I love documentaries, so I've watched loads of documentaries on stuff as well.
Well, listener, you can listen to those after you've listened to Confessions of a Book Collector. Anita, I love talking to you. You are a gifted, gifted storyteller, and I love working with you. And I can't wait for people to read The Good Lies, because it is a tremendous, clever, clever book, which I am so privileged and proud to represent. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Subscribe now to be one of the first to hear our new series, and follow Goldsborough Books on socials to keep up to date with our latest news and to discover who will be joining me on Confessions of a Book Collector.